From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn what Milwaukee's warmer-than-usual summer could mean for this winter.
Long-term predictions really predict that this winter will be La Niña that could favor a colder and wetter pattern.
Then we'll speak with the local voice actor featured in an Ojibwe dubbing of Star Wars A New Hope.
I hope this film inspires many people to either begin or continue studying the Ojibwe language.
Plus, gardening season isn't over yet. We'll visit Alice's garden to see what's growing there this time of the season. All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. It's officially fall, but it's not quite sweater weather yet. Cameron Miller is a meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Milwaukee. He says Milwaukee's summer weather will likely stick around for a while, but the rain from this summer and spring should help keep drought conditions at bay. Lake Effect's Excret Nunez is joined by Miller to learn what this warmer-than-usual weather could spell for this winter.
Personally, for me, it was my first summer living in Milwaukee, and it was definitely a muggy one. Why was it so rainy this summer?
So looking at the past observations that we had this summer, we usually run a regional model that does kind of a recap of what happened this past summer. And looking at that, we actually had a stronger jet stream over the upper Midwest. And usually when we have a stronger jet stream, we have more storms and a better storm track over the upper Midwest. So that's why we were getting more storms, more rain in the area than we would typically see, or at least in the past years we have seen around here.
Yeah. Do you know how much more did it rain this summer compared to previous years?
So surprisingly, in Milwaukee, we actually ended up right around average for basically the June, July, and August period. We usually measure our seasonal normals on a three-month period. So for Milwaukee, we ended up at 11 inches of rain, 11.71 actually inches of rain, which is about a third of an inch just above what the climate normals are for Milwaukee. Mm. But if you look a little bit west for Madison, we were actually, there was a lot more rain out there. They got about 20 inches of rain this past summer,
wow,
which is good for fifth in the top five summers for precipitation out here. For Milwaukee, unfortunately, 11 and three-quarter inches is right around 40 seconds, so kind of a typical summer for Milwaukee. But just had a lot of days where we had these piddly showers around, bringing rain chances around. So it seemed like we had a lot of days, but just added up to about normal for Milwaukee.
And so I guess, like, on the bright side for Madison's case, I guess, it seems the rain helped drought conditions compared to last year?
Yeah. So we've been on a slow improvement basically since October of last year. Looking at the U.S. Drought Monitor, we've basically been improving, and then we completely wiped out drought from the state basically from late June into late July, kind of with the precipitation that we had this past summer. So the particularly wet spring that we had helped us get a jump start on that, and then just continuing into the early summer here, especially parts west of Milwaukee, central Wisconsin and northern Wisconsin, that really helped remove the drought there.
And so let's talk about what's going on right now. It's officially fall, but it doesn't really feel like it. Why is it still so warm?
Yeah, that's also a really good question. So what's kind of been happening with the upper level pattern, we have these things called ridges and troughs in the upper atmosphere. So troughs are usually where the jet stream kind of dips and dips south across the United States. And then a ridge is where the jet stream raises north. So usually when you are under a ridge, you're going to have warmer temperatures. And when you are below a trough, you're going to have colder temperatures. So for this past three-week period or so, we've basically have had a trough over the western United States and a persistent ridge over the eastern United States. So with that ridge, we've had warmer temperatures coming north, and we've been well above normal basically in the entire eastern United States here. So Wisconsin's no exception.
Right. I was going to ask, is it normal to be so warm in September?
Not really. The climate normal for Milwaukee, at least this time of year, is right around 73. Mm. It's kind of interesting that about this time of year, we start to lose a degree from our normal temperatures about every 2 to 3 days. And looking at our normal temperatures, I mean, even though we're losing that degree every 2 to 3 days, we're staying well above that, especially with the weather pattern that's been going on.
So how long do you predict how warm it will be?
So that's really based on long-term climate models. We rely on the Climate Prediction Center, and they do outlooks generally the one-week period, the two-week period, and then they look at monthly and then three-month outlooks here. So the two-week outlook here that we have is actually predicting 70 to 80% chances for continuing above normal temperatures. Mm-hmm. So it looks like we might not see relief from temperatures that are greater than normal going into the later part of the month here. Granted, you know, that could mean that we'll drop out of the 80s and just still be above that 70 degree climate normal that we'll be at here in Milwaukee later in the month, but it's still looking like we'll be mostly above normal for our temperatures. And then for precip, our precipitation or rain, it's looking like we're going to be slightly below normal. So they're giving us 33% chances for below normal precipitation going into the later part of the month.
If we're going to be a little bit below precipitation, how could that affect how we go into winter?
Yeah, sure. So the drought monitor actually just reintroduced abnormally dry conditions to the Milwaukee area. And with below normal precipitation persisting, I don't think we'll slide into anything too extreme here. But, you know, remaining in that D0 abnormally dry or maybe D1, which is slight drought. But I would think that those are the two categories we'd look at here over the next couple weeks.
And so with these warmer than usual weather patterns, does this give us any indication of what's to come this winter in Milwaukee?
So that could be variable. Looking at some of the long-term predictions for this winter, we are predicted to go into La Nina conditions. And when we get La Nina conditions, typically over the upper Midwest, that means that the jet stream, the steering flow for storms in the winter, that'll move a little bit further south, give us a more active pattern, and a little bit colder. So we'll have to see just how strong that La Nina gets going into this winter, but long-term predictions really predict that this winter will be La Nina that could favor a colder and wetter pattern.
So maybe a little different than last year's winter?
Yeah, a little bit different. It felt like our winter was just condensed to a two-week period.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, luckily, I didn't experience that because I was in Mexico. Yeah, it's looking like, especially with that La Nina pattern, we typically get some of our snowier winters around here. So just got to see how it shakes out with time.
Well, Cameron, thanks so much for talking with me today and helping me understand Milwaukee's weather.
Yeah, no problem.
Cameron Miller is a meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Milwaukee, near Sullivan, Wisconsin. He spoke with Lake Effect's Excrit Nunez.
From Milwaukee's NPR, this is Capital Notes. We break down the big political news affecting Wisconsin. I'm Chuck Quernbach, filling in for Mayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WisPolitics.com. Here's our latest conversation. Well, hi, J.R. Welcome to the, well, we're about 40-plus days out edition of Capital Notes.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And the visits and the hits continue. Just in the last day or so, the Trump-Vance campaign announced a bus coming through Wisconsin in the first 3 days of this week. Not Donald Trump and J.D. Vance, but some others. What's the significance of that?
Oh, it's just the continuation of the campaign's trying to flood the zone, you could call it. We're having surrogates come in. I think we saw Governor Shapiro from Pennsylvania in Wisconsin this past weekend campaign with Tammy Baldwin. Anytime you can get somebody who's on your side out there in every nook and cranny of Wisconsin, they'll get some media attention. That's the whole point, is trying to get free publicity, free coverage of what they're talking about to generate some interest and buzz. But we're going to see, you know, Vance and Trump and Harris and Walz in here again, I'm sure, before the election. It shows you how important Wisconsin is. We are still one of the, you know, 4, 5, 6 states really matter. I've seen people talk about how Pennsylvania is the kind of linchpin for everything, because if Trump can just sweep the eastern coast states that are swing states, North Carolina, Georgia, and Pennsylvania, that's it. And for Harris, she has to win Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. She almost need that. Those are almost like must wins, unless you can open up another avenue to the key for electoral votes. So yeah, we're going to be important and get a lot of attention to the very end of the campaign.
This Trump bus tour, Team Trump bus tour, comes just a few days after Kamala Harris was in Madison at the Alliance Center. I was there, so were about 10,000 other people. Did she accomplish her goal, do you think, of firing up the vital Dane County base?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and Dane County is interesting. It is the one place in Wisconsin that I've seen get not just significantly bigger, but significantly bluer over the years. I mean, the way that it has become a turnout machine for Democrats is really impressive. Joe Biden won 75% of the vote there in 2020. Governor Evers won 77% roughly in 2022. You know, Donald Trump is going to have a hard time winning Wisconsin if he can't get more than 23% of the vote in Dane County. It is just a turnout machine, and it's really where a lot of people live. So he's got his work cut out for him to try and dig into that Democratic advantage. Like, meanwhile, you know, Harris wants to come here and kind of get the base jazzed up. She wants them engaged in turning out, especially campuses, get them engaged. We saw from the Harris campaign last week that they've opened up a new coordinating campaign office right next to the UW Madison campus. It's all geared toward college kids. And, you know, if you can get those guys to turn out, it's a boost for your campaign.
On the vice presidential level, we've seen visits from both Tim Walz and J.D. Vance just in the last couple of weeks. We've got the vice presidential debate coming up on October 1st. What do we know about whether Walz, the Minnesotan, is helping the Democratic ticket any more than Vance is helping the Republicans?
Well, we know that Tim Walz is not as disliked as J.D. Vance is, at least according to the polls that we've seen, where Walz, at least the Marquette poll, I believe, he was actually in positive territory for his favorable, unfavorable rating. J.D. Vance is upside down. I don't know that voters are really truly voting or deciding their ballot based off of the VP nominees, but, you know, they're surrogates who are important messengers in this campaign. Democrats will argue that, you know, Walz has got a unique potential appeal in Wisconsin because, remember, you know, Western Wisconsin up there around St. Croix County, you know, they get Minneapolis TV. So they've seen Tim Walz, you know, on a regular basis, and the news accounts are getting on TV and radio. So to the Democrats, they think that's a plus. You know, remember, it's not necessarily about winning a place like St. Croix for Democrats, St. Croix County. It's a Republican county, but if you can change the margin there, just improve by a couple points, that helps. Just like with Dane County with Donald Trump. Trump's not going to win Dane County, not even come close. But if he can lose it by less than what he lost it in 2020, that's a positive. So there, you're looking to try and find every voter you can, even places where maybe your message isn't that well received by the overall population. If you find enough people, it makes sense.
I have a fun football question I just thought of. The Vikings are at the Packers next Sunday. Does it help Tim Walz at the voting booth if the Packers beat the Vikes?
Excellent question. It will put people in a good mood, but don't forget that game's a month before Election Day, so a lot can happen. Let's see if Jordan Love's healthy by Sunday, okay?
So moving on back to the real world of Get Out the Vote, I attended a SEIU event in Milwaukee Saturday, about a few hundred people getting ready to go out and canvass for Kamala Harris. We're in Get Out the Vote season. How important is it?
People will tell you who are involved in campaigns that a Get Out the Vote organization, they can't change the tide, right? If there's a wave election coming, you're not going to prevent that wave if you're on the other side of it. However, in a jump ball campaign like we're in right now, it can be worth a couple of points. What's really fascinating is that Donald Trump and Republicans really haven't built a comparable turnout machine in Wisconsin to what Democrats have. Democrats have way more offices, way more volunteers, or sorry, way more paid employees. But what Republicans are doing is interesting. A group called Turning Point USA, a conservative group, they are doing all kinds of voter registration drives, especially on college campuses. They're trying to reach people. They're trying to chase votes. That's unique. Usually you don't kind of like contract that out if you're a campaign. You do that in-house or with the state party. This is a unique circumstance where Trump is more focused on quote-unquote election integrity. That's where he wants his money to go. And they're allowing these other groups who aren't under control of the party or necessarily coordinating with them to do the turnout effort, to do the registration push. It's really kind of a gamble, but if it works, great. You know, it's just not the way it's usually done around here in Wisconsin.
JR, one more question about the presidential race in Wisconsin, the ballot status of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He's trying to get off the ballot. Where do things stand right now?
The Supreme Court over the weekend denied a request from Kennedy for oral arguments, gave him the opportunity to file an amended brief, which he did. And really, it's just a matter of when the court's going to rule. Look, when the court decided to take this case, Rebecca Bradley, conservative, kind of lamented some things procedurally. It's really in the weeds, but how the court took this case was a little bit unique. Nonetheless, Bradley wrote in her dissent that this is kind of how things work when the majority has his mind made up what it wants to do. That wasn't taken as a great sign for Kennedy that he's going to be able to make any headway with the Supreme Court's liberal majority. That, you know, like a couple of things working against him. One, even Republicans tell me that state law is pretty clear. Once you file nomination papers, you can't take them back. That's just not the way it works. So unless that law is somehow unconstitutional, you're not going to be able to convince the court, Supreme Court, that, hey, you shouldn't be, law shouldn't apply to you. Two, we are well past the time when ballots have been printed. Actually, they're actually out to people have absentee ballots on file already. Some probably been marked and even like sent back to clerks. So we are in the election. It's going on as we speak. It is hard to imagine the court saying, you know what, we're going to scrap everything and start over. Or, yeah, let's put stickers on ballots, even though we've got tens of thousands already out in voters' hands. Like, it's just a unique case. And then you got timing. I mean, like, the Supreme Court 4 years ago, the Green Party, trying to get on the ballot, said, hey, you waited too long to file this thing. Ballots were already out, printed, in the process of being printed. Clerks already kind of getting things going on. You waited too long. So Kennedy filed his lawsuit like 4 years of the day after the Greens did. So you've got all those things working against him. It's just people don't think he's got a great chance of winning logistically or legally in this case. So the bet is the court will probably rule against Kennedy. Question, is that going to be it? Will we go to federal court after that? It's really interesting. And two, will there be some push down the road to change the law? Because remember, if you're an independent candidate for president, you had a deadline of August 6th to turn in nomination papers in Wisconsin. If you are a candidate for a major party, your deadline is really kind of the first Tuesday in September. It's in state law. The reason that is because those who file nomination papers, you have to have time for the Elections Commission to go through those nomination papers and check signatures. It's different than, you know, just getting a notification from the Democratic Party, Republican Party, hey, here's our person. So is that unfair? You know, the courts may decide that down the road, or there may be a push from lawmakers to change that. But, you know, for now, it looks like he probably will be on the ballot in Wisconsin. The question then becomes, is that going to make a big difference? Because he's not running, he's backing Trump. So the question is, who's still supporting Robert F. Kennedy Jr.?
So there's been a lot more excitement, I think, from the Democrats, maybe the Republicans, about some of the legislative races. You hear the Democrats saying, we can win the assembly back, maybe make gains in the Senate. I don't know if that's correct, but there's more national money coming in for the Democrats, some of the Democrats running for legislature. Is that true of Republicans, too?
Yeah, we're seeing national Dems, Republicans starting to play in legislative races. What is kind of clear from the ad buys that we've seen is that Democrats just have more money, and thanks to the state party. The state party has been a fundraising machine with Ben Wickler as chair and Governor Evers in the East Wing. And that prowess has been able to then filter down to candidates and to the legislative campaign committees. Now, Republicans aren't, you know, dirt poor or anything like that. They've got their own funds, but they can't match what Democrats have. But, you know, that's not the end-all be-all. You can hustle an assembly district on doors and be quite effective. And so there are ways to kind of make up that fundraising disparity. And the question, too, again, is what's the environment going to be like come November 5th? Is it going to be a Harris win by a couple points in Wisconsin, or Trump win by a couple, like a true jump ball? With the maps that we have in the assembly, Democrats in the top of the ticket to basically win Wisconsin by a couple, 3 points, they have a path to the majority. For Republicans, 50-50 presidential race, they probably, I stress probably, hold on the majority in the assembly. In the Senate, it's about narrowing the majority for Democrats. Democrats don't have a real path to flip the chamber this session. They went this year to 2022 to 10 super minority. Really, there are about four seats in play. They got to flip three of them to have a chance in 2026 to take control of the majority. If they only win two or one or none, there's no path in 2026. So the stakes are really about, can they flip three of those four seats and have a path? And they flip all four, they've got an even better chance in 2026. So that's why I'm watching the Senate this year.
One quick question about a congressional race up in the 8th District, Green Bay area. There's going to be a debate Friday night. Dr. Kristen Lierley, the Democratic candidate, against Republican Tony Weed. This is the seat that's basically open right now because Mike Gallagher has stepped away. Significance of the debate, significance of that race?
If Tony Weed had some real major blow up, the human viral moment, that might be bad for him. But that's such a Republican district that people are only talking about that. There's a lot more attention on the 3rd in Western Wisconsin, a little bit on the 1st in Southeastern Wisconsin. But that the 8th is a pretty Republican seat. You'd have to have a wave year for Democrats and have Tony Weed do something really, really bad and Kristen Lierley do something really, really good to have that run be competitive. And so right now, people aren't really talking about that race so much. So for Weed, avoid the big mistake in the debate. Don't then go viral and you should be okay.
Okay, JR, Mayan back next time. Thanks very much.
Hey, thanks for the time.
That was J.R. Ross of WisPolitics.com speaking with me, WUWM's Chuck Quernbach. Check out the Capital Notes podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
That was WUWM's Chuck Quernbach, standing in for Mayan Silver for Capital Notes. You can hear it every other week on Lake Effect and during Morning Edition. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 15 minutes, we'll head to Alice's garden to see what's growing as the gardening season is slowly wrapping up. But first, we'll speak with a local voice actor who helped bring to life the Ojibwe language version of Star Wars, A New Hope. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The Star Wars universe was first introduced in 1977 with the film A New Hope. Since then, there have been many more films, series, and books that have kept us in a galaxy far, far away. Recently, the Star Wars universe expanded to include multi-generational Anishinaabe. The classic film Star Wars A New Hope has been dubbed in Ojibwe. The project is part of wider efforts to revitalize the language, which is used for one of the largest Native American tribes in the U.S.
Yahoo!
Nigani, Anamaki, and Nini is the language culture coordinator of the Red Cliff Nation in northern Wisconsin, and is also the voice actor for the character Red Leader in Star Wars. He joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share his experience bringing this version of the film to life.
Nigani, welcome to Lake Effect. It's a pleasure to meet you.
It's a pleasure meeting you, Audrey.
So first off, are you a Star Wars fan?
Absolutely, since I was a child. How about you?
Absolutely. As I will show you over Zoom, the listeners can't see, but I have a Millennium Falcon tattoo.
What?
So, yes, Star Wars fan ever since I was little. My uncles first introduced me to the series, and they, of course, grew up with the original trilogy. So what was your first Star Wars exposure that got you hooked?
Well, if you remember in the 90s, they re-edited the original Star Wars. And so I watched those in theaters when I was a kid, and yeah, I've been a huge fan ever since.
Excellent. So you are a voice actor in the new release of Star Wars A New Hope in Ojibwe. So can you share how you heard of this opportunity and what the audition process was like? Because auditions were held in Manitoba, right?
Yeah. So I was perusing Facebook after work, like so many of us do. And I saw on one of my friends' pages an ad to apply to audition. And so that's where I learned about it first. And yes, the actual recording was in Winnipeg.
Okay. And did you know you were auditioning for the character of Red Leader, or was this just an open call, be a part of Star Wars?
Great question. So after I applied, I was invited to audition and to choose from several main characters to audition for. So I chose a handful, and the process was I had to record on my own computer, reading lines in Ojibwe per character. And I was using my best intonations akin to what I was seeing in the original Star Wars, and then listening to the elders in my head to try and pronounce the Ojibwe the best I could. And I sent those in, and not long after, maybe a week or so, I heard back from the Disney crew asking for me to audition for one of those particular characters. We did the audition over Zoom with a director and one of her assistants. And, you know, I said the first two lines for this particular character, and she said, hold on. She offered me some suggestions. I took her suggestions to heart. I read the lines again, just one or two sentences. And then she said, you know what? I've heard enough. I've seen enough. I really like what you're doing here. I'm going to give you a role in Star Wars.
But you weren't sure which. It was just like, we're going to include you. Just wait and see.
Yes. Didn't know yet which character. And I'm so proud to be giving voice to Red Leader, acted on screen by the late Drew Henley.
Of course. I mean, it's a big part, especially in the pivotal Death Star battle at the end of the film. And I can't imagine how anxious you were just, okay, knowing I'm going to be involved, don't know who or what so far. With Disney, and you think of Marvel movies, you know, were there NDAs, you know, where you kept under secret oath until, you know, the official word was out?
Yes, absolutely. We had to sign an NDA. I didn't, in fact, know who many of the actors were going to be until the release, the official news release.
Okay. So yeah, let's go into a bit more about the actual process of being a voice actor for A New Hope in Ojibwe. You're tasked with Red Leader. So did you also have to translate your part only, or was it a wider effort to help translate the whole Star Wars film? Can you just share how this process kind of unfolded for you?
Absolutely. So thankfully, Pat Nangawants, a first language speaker up north and a gifted teacher, she led a team of translators before these auditions. So the film was all of the script was translated ahead of time. And so when I was auditioning, I was given lines, and not just given lines on paper, but also a recording of an elder pronouncing the lines to give some enunciation guidelines there as well. And so I didn't have to do any of the translating. I'm so grateful for Pat Nangawants and her team.
Well, and I like that detail of having a recording of an elder as well, because, you know, you can share better insight than I in this, but how important is having that elder's voice and pronunciation and style? Because with keeping a language alive, I imagine that's crucial to keep the language as accurate as you can.
100%, Audrey. If one pronounces a word just slightly differently, it can offer a huge, entirely different meaning to a word.
So with your work in voicing Red Leader, can you share a bit of your methodology or technique? Was it either to mirror the original actor's cadence of the lines, or were you able to enjoy some freedom in interpreting it in your own way to best serve the Ojibwe language?
Great question. So how I've been taught, Ojibwe tends to have a flatness to it. There aren't as many accenting, if you will. And in English, of course, there is an accent and stresses in the words. And so I asked the production team, do you want me to offer a flat traditional Ojibwe pronunciation, or do you want me to emanate the English actors? And they invited me to shoot towards the English actors. And so what I did was I watched the original scene over and over and over and over again. I did some background research. I found that Mr. Henley had negotiated with George Lucas. And at first, Mr. Lucas wanted Red Leader to be anxious from the beginning on out. And Mr. Henley thought that this character is a professional. He has years of experience. He's going to be calm throughout. And so what they negotiated, what they agreed upon was, at first, Red Leader would be very calm and collected. And towards the end of that scene, when things are getting quite heated, he's going to grow a little more anxious. And so I brought that information with me into the sound studio. And the director also invited certain emotions, certain loudness, guiding me in the studio as well.
I love that. I also love that I learned a new Star Wars fact today with that background of the actor. Did you go into like Lucasfilm archives? Where did you find some of this research? Or did the director have some additional information for you all to really connect with this film on a deeper level like that?
I just dug in online.
That's a great resource.
Usually.
Yeah. Turn to all the Star Wars nerds online. They'll have an answer.
Wait. There's a lot out there.
Yeah. And with the Ojibwe language, as you mentioned, being a little more flat, the scene you're in is a battle scene. And I love this insight that you start calm, but obviously things heat up. Spoiler alert, Darth Vader eventually shoots you down. You crash into the Death Star. But what were some of the best challenges or learning experiences about being involved in this film?
Oh, it was a great experience working in the studio. It was my first Hollywood film studio setup. And so it was me in the sound booth, and then the booth next to me was the director, her production team, and an elder. And this elder was able to offer any pronunciation guidance on the fly in the studio, which is great. He was able to correct a couple of my words. And that was a really fun experience. And, you know, joking with him back and forth in Ojibwe, that felt really good.
Having the experience of recording, voicing Red Leader, having the director, an elder there with you, it seems like such a great interactive experience. And this is obviously part of a much wider effort for all the voice actors involved in A New Hope. What significance do you place on the role of Ojibwe language in popular films like Star Wars?
You know, Pat Ngawant said it really well. She, earlier this year, was the keynote speaker at Anishinaabe Mwantaig, the world's largest conference on the revitalization of Anishinaabe language. And in her speech, she offered a vision of, within 100 years, all of our communities are doing everyday things in our language. So that's an Ojibwe person being able to go to the store, go to the school, watch films. Anything that you can do in English, you can also do in Ojibwe. So a part of this vision is making sure that films are either dubbed or produced in the Ojibwe language. So this is just one small tool to help in this larger revitalization effort.
And how does it feel for you personally to be a part of the Star Wars universe in your language?
It's an incredible honor. It's an incredible honor.
So if you're willing, I'd love to give listeners a little taste of your work in the film. Would you like to toss lines back and forth? I'll say the English and you can share the Ojibwe translation that you worked on.
Sure, let's do a few.
All right. So we are acting as Red Leader here. I'll start with the first line. Cut the chatter, Red 2.
Bunkatoon, Red 2.
Red boys, this is Red Leader.
Red Migazoo, mean Red Leader.
And the classic, pivotal line of Red Leader. Almost there.
Aja Giga. Aja Giga.
And unfortunately, your first target miss just impacted the surface. Oh, this is so much fun. Thank you. So this is your first taste of acting, right? Of voice acting?
This is my first taste of voice acting. I've done a few small things in terms of acting. I'm also a film producer and director, but I want to expand more into voice acting and acting.
How did this experience of voice acting outside of the other projects you've worked on give you more insight into room to grow, not just for yourself, but for more production and projects for Ojibwe language-led films or translated films?
So many of my lines are actually yelled into the microphone. And I'm not much of a yeller. I'm not a very loud person. And so that took a lot of effort for me. And the director, she said, many of the Indigenous actors she's worked with struggle with being extra loud. And so that's one area I want to work on.
Well, what a project to get you started on voice acting. Congratulations to you and the whole effort of this film. Nagani, thank you for joining me on Like Effect to share more about it.
Thank you so much. And I want to ask the audience, if you haven't seen this film yet, if you're a fan of Star Wars, if you're a fan of a good story, if you're interested in learning more Ojibwe, I strongly encourage you to go watch this film. It may still be in theaters in the Milwaukee area, I'm not sure. But if not, come October, the film will be on APTN and then on Disney Plus. I hope this film inspires many people to either begin or continue studying the Ojibwe language.
May the Force be with you.
And may the Force be with you.
Nigani Anamaki Anini is a voice actor for Star Wars Ojibwe, who gives voice to the character Red Leader. He's also the language culture coordinator for the Red Cliff Ojibwe Nation in northern Wisconsin. Anini spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. It may be fall, but gardening season isn't over yet. We'll visit Alice's garden next to see what's growing. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. It may seem like the end of the growing season, but at Alice's Garden on Milwaukee's north side, things are still buzzing. Many plants are producing more now than at any other time in the season. I joined executive director and digging contributor Venus Williams at the garden to explore what's growing right now and what's still to come this season in the garden.
It's my favorite time of the growing season because there's just so much goodness, and the earth is offering us a depth of wellness. Like these plants that are so abundant and prolific right now are the ones that offer us so much healing well into wintertime, such as this gorgeous elderberry bush. And those flowers up there, I was sitting back there thinking, how can we get to those flowers? And then I realized they're just an offering. You're not gonna kill yourself trying to climb up to get those elder flowers.
There are a lot of things still in the garden. I think we get to September and people assume, you know, summer's over, the garden is done. But, you know, looking around right now, you can see there's still so much.
Everything is still growing. I'm trying to think of what is finished, and there really isn't anything right now that is completely done. There are things that we are replanting, like lettuce and radish, arugula, beets. But look at these Brussels sprouts. They will go well into November. They will be the very last things we harvest. We will harvest these Brussels sprouts probably in November and bring them to the Milwaukee Winter Farmers Market.
There's even still flowers.
Yes. I tell people all the time, if you plant orange and purple flowers especially, they take you well into the end of September and into October. I haven't done my research on why, but there's something in the coloring of orange and purple flowers that go well into autumn. But of course, we planted these marigolds because they're such companion plants and pest control, more like rabbit control. Marigolds are such a, you know, they have such a strong odor. And look at this. So on one hand, we have plants that are on their final journey for this season. They are creating their babies, creating their seeds, like that bronze fennel and the dill. But at the same time, you see a field of lettuce that has just been planted and will not be harvested until October. And this particular farmer will bring this lettuce to the West Allis Farmers Market.
What are some of the more, maybe surprising is the wrong word, but what are some plants that people think of as being really the height of summer that are still producing right now?
Tomatoes, of course. I love it because every single year, and I think we've talked about this before, I start getting those crazy messages at the end of June or the beginning of July, my tomatoes aren't growing. What could I do to get my tomatoes to be ready? And I tell them absolutely nothing. And then we get to September and it's like, oh my gosh, I have so many tomatoes. What am I going to do with all of these tomatoes? If we allow it to, the earth teaches us so many things, such as patience. Be patient with the tomatoes. They know when they are supposed to be ready. You may want them ready for the 4th of July, but they're not going to be ready for the 4th of July. So you're going to have to just wait and enjoy them for Labor Day.
I'm seeing some tomatoes here, of course, and some basil.
Yes. Basil is one of the first things that will go if we get a frost, because it is such a water-based plant. There is so much water in that basil leaf that if we, you know, the minute we get a frost, it's going to go brown, which still doesn't mean you can't utilize it. It's just no longer pretty and will stop growing. It definitely will stop growing. The other myth with basil is if it's flowers, it's no good. And that is so not true. It's such a false myth. The flower is actually more powerful in taste than the leaf itself. And then once it flowers, you know, you cut it back and then it continues to come and go. Look at that beautiful butterfly on that zinnia.
Oh yeah.
Mm.
Is that a swallowtail?
That's a swallowtail.
The little guys who end up eating your dill.
Yes.
But turn into a beautiful butterfly.
Well, fortunately, we have enough dill out here for all of creation. So it can eat a bunch of dill, but we still have plenty to share. The other thing about the abundance of this particular urban farm is there are 100 plots here representing about 87 families and community organizations. Some people and organizations have multiple plots. You see the plants themselves. I see the people we are also cultivating in this space, and the people who are nourishing each other. That is part of the beauty of urban farming and community gardening. It's not just about the food we produce. It's also about the relationships and the beauty of sharing across cultural and socioeconomic and all of these things, ethnicity, race, these things that often separate us. A community garden, an urban farm, if utilized in its fullness, allows people to come together as we grow food and we help nourish and strengthen our own souls and our spirits.
How many cultures would you say are represented in this garden? Can you count that?
No. I did one year, but even this year, there are three new families who originate off the continent of Africa. Then there are the Hmong farmers, the Burmese community, who is also represented here. When people fill out their rental plot application for Alice's Garden, it used to just have, you know, black, white. Well, under Caucasian now, I put, you know, identify, you know, what's your heritage? Is it French?
Is it Scottish? Is it German? You know, we very often lump all the white people together. No, we need to celebrate and to honor all that is represented in this space. One year, about 15 years ago, was over there on the east side of the garden, and Seed Folks, the middle school book by Paul Fleischman, is one of my favorite stories. It's the story of how 13 different people from 13 different backgrounds come together in Cleveland to turn a vacant lot into a community garden. And so I used to have a ministry called Seed Folks Youth Ministry. And Seed Folks was my dream for Milwaukee, like what it means to come together and build something beautiful. Well, more than a decade ago, maybe 15 years ago, again on that east side, I looked up and there were 8 different languages being spoken in this garden, and I just bawled like a little baby. Because it's like, you know, when you invite people into wellness, when you invite people into something that's whole, that is nurturing, that dream gets created. And that's what community gardening represents, is the ability to cultivate community in the most healthy of settings. Let's go over here and look at these beautiful collard greens.
Oh, yeah. Now, do collard greens, do they like when it gets colder, or are they really in it for the heat?
They are in it for the goodness and the deliciousness of it. So, what, again, another myth is that you need to wait until the first frost to harvest collard greens. Where does that come from? Well, of course, Milwaukee is a great migration city. And so a lot of the African-American community that's here now, and especially our elders, they came from Arkansas and Mississippi and Louisiana, where it was really hot. And if you harvested those greens end of summer, midsummer, yes, they were bitter. And so you wanted that first frost to tenderize them. We don't need that here. So when people tell me they harvest their collard greens just one time a year after the first frost, I'm like, well, that's just really dumb. Because at this point, we have harvested this patch right here of collard greens at least a dozen times. And this is going to keep coming back. You're just bending back the leaves. So it's really important to understand geography when farming and gardening. And we'll probably get another, maybe 3 more harvests from these collard greens, and then they will go to seed, and then we'll plant some new ones. But allow the earth to do what it knows how to do. Don't dig up your collard greens, your kale, your turnips, any of those. Keep them in the soil. The soil will be safe harbor and safe space for them. And especially whether it's fortunately or unfortunately now with climate change, there are so many plants that used to be annuals that are now understanding themselves. They're changing their identity and they're becoming perennials in this zone.
Yeah, it's one of those things where if you talk to older gardeners especially, they'll say, oh, well, you know, this plant, it's really going to die off. You're not going to have that through the next year. And then next year comes around and you're saying, oh, well,
like, what did you say? Who told me that? It's another way that we keep up with the time.
One of the things, of course, we're hearing quite a number of bugs in the garden, but I'm also seeing a lot of bees.
A lot of bees. We have an apiary. So over there in that southeast corner, we do have hives and honey that is ready to be harvested by the beekeeper here, Benny Higgins, who has put so much love and energy into this apiary. This is his first time. He's a novice beekeeper, and boy, has he been dedicated and committed. So we're looking forward to bringing Alice's Garden honey to market by the end of this month.
Looking around the garden, I have a feeling that you're spending less time inside, but when you are, what have you been reading?
Right now I am reading Spice Apothecary, Blending and Using Common Spices for Everyday Health by Bevan Clare. Earlier today, we harvested probably 20 pounds of fennel seeds. And I can't wait to use them in teas, make some creams, but spices are where I'm hanging out right now.
All right. Well, Venus, thank you so much for inviting us to the garden.
Please come back anytime. I love showing off this magical place.
Venus Williams is the executive director of Alice's Garden and the Fondy Food Center. She's also our regular dig-in contributor. You can find our previous conversations at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll look at the state of working Wisconsin and explore how wages have been impacted by low unemployment. Plus, we'll speak with the author of a new children's book based on the girls' Muslim basketball team at Salaam School in Milwaukee. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.